Product Breakfast Club. Product Breakfast Club. Hey, everybody. It's the Product Breakfast Club, and I am your host, Jake Knapp, in San Francisco. I'm your only host today because I'm doing an interview, and I am interviewing a writer, illustrator named Liz Fosslane. Liz, did I say your name right?
Yes, perfect.
I did. Okay, yep. Now I just sort of gave it away. Liz is actually listening right now to me doing the intro. I gave it all away, but Liz, you can pretend again that you're not here as I describe who you are, what you've done. So Liz is the author and illustrator of a new book that's out called No Hard Feelings, The Secret Power of Embracing Emotion at Work. And it's a book that's doing quite well. It's also a beautiful book. We'll talk about that. Liz, having illustrated it and being a designer, knows how hard that is to achieve. We'll talk about that. I've had regrets with how some books have turned out. So Liz nailed it with her book. So No Hard Feelings is out there, and it's a pretty fascinating topic. Liz, in the past, has coached leaders at companies like Google, Facebook, Nike, and Stanford. So pretty good companies. I don't know. I guess those are all right. Previously, Liz worked as executive editor at Rap Genius, also known as Genius. You know, that really cool, weird lyrics website. We can talk about that. And her works appeared in The Economist, Financial Times, CNN, NPR. Liz is a badass. And I'm not sure why you gave us your time to show up on the show, but thank you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Well, I love sprint and make time. So I decided to make time for this podcast.
I feel like that using that as the name of the book, I've sort of ruined that phrase forever. It sounds like I'm making a sales pitch, like, oh, I can make time if you're listening, buy make time. But also buy no hard feelings. So right before we started recording this, which was a bit of a fiasco, every time when I am responsible for doing the audio, it's so hard. I don't know why it's so hard to just record audio, but it is. But anyway, you were saying that you've been sick. So how are you, Liz? How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah. I think it was a sinus infection, but it's one of those really annoying things where after kind of being sick and sneezy for a week, I went to the doctor. And in 2019, she said that there was no medication she could give me. It's probably a virus. And it just had to run its course. And she's like, it'll probably last another week or so. So I am really frustrated by the state of medicine right now.
I feel like in those situations, shouldn't they just give you a placebo? I mean, totally. If they really,
yeah, just give me Smarties or something.
I feel like whenever I go to the doctor and I'm not given something, I'm like, come on, give me a placebo.
I know.
Like, let me go away with a bottle of something.
I know. Or as an adult, they don't even give you a lollipop. You get nothing.
There's nothing. There's no treasure box.
Yeah. It's hard.
That sucks. There's been a lot of, I mean, I'm sorry for you. I'm glad you're feeling better and everything, but I'm kind of gratified to hear that somebody else got tripped up by being sick, because I feel like the whole winter here, either I've been sick or one after another, the succession of family members has been sick, including our dog.
I know, pneumonia. You said your puppy got really sick.
Yeah, he's better now, but like, I mean, it's just, we're so frail as humans.
I know.
Like we have all these grand plans about things I'm going to do. And then it's like, I can't do anything. So
the only thing that's nice about being sick is I feel it does kind of recalibrate for me what I need to be anxious about. Because pre-sick, I'm just like, my inbox, I'm so stressed about all these emails and this tweet that I sent and this Instagram post. And then during sick, I'm like, I'm so zen. I'm just like, it doesn't matter. As long as I have my health, I have everything. But then the moment I'm better, I'm just like, Twitter, inbox.
So I was just going to say, are you able to transfer any of that to, but no is the answer, I guess.
I always plan to. I'm always like, once I'm healthy, I'm just going to live life and enjoy it. And then, you know, 3 days after regaining full health, I'm just back where I was.
We always do this thing with our kids where when, like, my younger son has swim lessons and every week he's like, he doesn't want to go. And then he loves it, you know, when he goes. And we started doing this thing a few years ago, I guess when it got really easy to record videos on the phone, where we would, like, after the thing had happened that was, you know, that the kid anticipated being stressful or whatever, we'd record a video of them talking to their future self and being like, oh, hey, Luke, or hey, Flynn, because that's their names. We'd say, hey, you just got done with swimming. Like, how was it? And then they would say, oh, you know, it was fun. Oh, it's great. Like, what would you tell yourself next week? Like, oh, you should go. And then we would play that for them, which sometimes helps. And I always actually sometimes think like, oh, now that I'm, to use your example, now that I'm sick and I know that it's not really a big deal if I don't check my email, I should tell my future self. But I'm like, no, I'm an adult. I'll remember.
I love that. I think I'm going to start doing that after I go to the gym and just be like, look, I have all these endorphins. I feel really good. Get off the couch.
Yeah. There's a thing in, I can't remember where I heard about this, this concept of like what we do for our future selves to try to make our future selves happy. And then like our present self is always like, oh, past me was such an idiot, you know, like, like made such a bad choice for me that I'm stuck with. And it would be really interesting if you did that to see how much you value, you know, what your previous self said.
I was just talking about this with someone yesterday and they wanted to design an experiment where, so their theory is that people who care more about their future selves or like in that mindset are much more likely in a parking lot to drive through to the other space so that it's like easier to get out. And so she was like, how do we set up a parking lot and then measure this? And I was like, that sounds like actually a pretty cool study.
It actually seems like it would isolate. I mean, unless you have to go to the bathroom or something. There could be some things that occasionally would put some noise in there, but yeah, that's fascinating.
Or what happened to me most recently, because I was thinking about my future self. And so I drove forward without, I think I was just thinking of something else. And then there was one of those little like bumps in between each of the parking spaces. And so when I drove forward, I accidentally drove over this bump. And it was like such painful car screeching noises that I will almost certainly never drive forward again. Because I was like, how much damage am I doing to my car right now?
Yeah, but your future self did get to just pull right out. Nose first. Oh, man. Well, so your book is out there. What is day-to-day life or week-to-week life like for you right now? How do you feel about writing the book? You can do it again?
Yeah, it's this weird thing where I'm really curious if you had this too, that this book just was kind of all-consuming for the past 3 years, just the research, interviews, illustrating, and then writing is its own beast. And it's weird now that it's released to the world, I very much feel cleansed of it. I'm like, it's out. I can't change anything. The launch happened. I'm ready to put it to rest a little bit, but it's at the same time when all of my friends get to see it and like everyone wants to talk to me about it. So it's been amazing. It's really cool to see people resonate with the content and then also love the illustrations and get feedback around that. But it's just such a weird, I think the emotional journey for the author is when you just can't really put more energy into this. It's like, oh, now is the time when I actually would love to have so much energy around this.
Yes, totally.
Like, it's good. Like, I really am excited about everything, but it's also, I think I'm trying to like be more conscious of taking the time away from it and sort of giving myself time to recharge so that I can have excitement and like actually connect with people around it in the way that I want to.
Well, I think that's very wise because this is a book that people are going to be interested in for a long time. And it's not like people are going to stop having emotions at work and stuff, right? And stop like also just feeling like weird stuff is going on and I want to have better strategies for handling it. Yeah. It feels very timeless, like the topic. So if you want to, you're going to be talking about this like forever. So it is probably a really good idea to not burn out on it. But I can totally relate to that feeling of like, oh, I wish I had some of that beginning enthusiasm or even just the like there's a good feeling about crafting something. You know?
And what's so hard is that everyone else for the past 3 years, I've been like, there's a book coming. There's a book coming.
Yeah.
There's nothing to show you.
Yes. Right.
And then now it's all of a sudden like, oh God, so much feedback.
There it is. Yeah. The kinds of activities that are typically involved in promoting the book, they're much less enjoyable to me than making the thing. Like making it is fun. And then it's like doing podcasts. Like you must be getting sick of that, like telling the same story over and over again, you know, and like, oh yeah, and like, here's what it's about. And here's sort of, and I'm going to make you do that, of course, but like, it's a funny thing. It's like a funny thing that like, as a writer, so much of, I think the success of the book in the long term does depend on that continuing talking about it, but it is not the same energy source or the same like set of activities that probably got you interested in doing the thing in the first place.
Yeah. And to be a writer is an introvert's absolute dream job. And then you have this massive switch where it's like, now you need to be extremely extroverted for months.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah.
Podcasts actually like it's, you know, I can be in my apartment and then it's the one-on-one conversation, which is really fun. I think the weirdest for me is being so self-promotional, like even hearing you read my bio, it's just like,
you're right. Weird. Yes. It's like, it's you and I have hung out before. You're a very self-promotional person. I mean, that really comes across strongly.
Great. Yeah.
Well, actually, while we're speaking of your book and while we're speaking of like being introverted, mm-hmm. I'm going to mortify you by reading some of the blurbs on your book because they're so good. And I know as an author that it's really hard to get good blurbs. Like, you know, you have to have some kind of a connection with the person who you, and the blurbs, that's a bit of author slang Liz and I can throw around. But if you don't know what a blurb is, if you're listening, blurbs are like the little quotes on the back of the book from like writers or famous people or whatever. And so to get those, like you have to have some connection to the person. Somehow you have to either know the person or know somebody who knows them. And then you got to ask, which is like, that's like I hate that. Like, hey, person who I've probably never done anything for. And, you know, and like, could you read my book and, or, you know, review it to the extent that you feel comfortable then saying how great it is? Like, it's just like, oh, but you've got great ones. So I just have to read a couple real quick. So speaking of introversion, Susan Cain, who wrote Quiet, which is an amazing book, and she's so smart. And she says, No Hard Feelings is a must read that topples the idea that emotions don't belong in the workplace, offers a path towards a future I want to work in, an emotionally expressive yet respectful and high-performing workplace. That is a really nice one. Mm-hmm. You've got Kim Scott, author of Radical Candor. She has also been on the podcast here and is fantastic. And she says, this book will help you build the emotional discipline you need to succeed. That's hardcore. Cal Newport, big fan of Cal Newport. And I don't know how you got him to do this because I don't think you probably had to write this on like papyrus and send it to him. You can't just like email that guy. He's in like a seclusion, like monastery somewhere. Check this out. He says, No Hard Feelings is one of the most original, insightful, and laugh out loud funny business books I've read in a long time. It'll transform the way you think about the role of feelings in the workplace. And Adam Grant, super big deal writer. Adam Grant says, if you've ever thought it best to check your emotions at the office door, this book will change your mind. He goes on to talk about lively illustrations, practical examples. Anyway, I'll stop because I know that it's probably awful to hear me read those out loud, but you should feel really good about those. They're fantastic. And they go along with, I think, the success the book's already having. I feel like one of the most interesting things to talk about, like we'll get to talking about what's in the book too, but I'm always interested in like, how did you get to where you are now? So somehow you are in the place where as an illustrator and a writer, you have created this book that is like a big enough deal to get published by a major publisher, by Penguin, and to get quotes from all these famous people who are the leading experts on work. I would say those people are like, everyone would say those are like the leading experts on work. They're talking about what you did. Where did that start for you? Tell me about it.
Yeah. So I think I'll tell the story, but first I want to flag like the biggest lesson that will show up multiple times in the story for me in this whole process has been, even if there's a 1% chance that someone will respond to your email, send the email. Take the 5 to 20 minutes to craft the email. Like even if it's to someone like Adam Grant, that was one where we definitely were like, he's so prolific. He does so much stuff.
Yeah.
Small chance he'll respond, but then he did. And so I think if you write in a human way and you really believe in what you're writing and you're like genuinely interested in the other person, you know, the worst thing that happens is that you never get a response and that's not so bad.
Well, actually, wait. I want to interrupt you because I want the answer to the original question and everything, but this is super interesting. Like, even the details, let's just take the email to Adam Grant, for an example. Mm-hmm. You talked about write in a human way. You mentioned like some things that you thought about, but could you like zoom in on that? How did you write that message in a way that he responded?
So I'll say for the Adam Grant, I should call this up. but yeah, I think we wrote like, hey, we're really big fans of your book. At that time, we already had the Susan Cain blurb. So we mentioned that. And then I also attached some illustrations from the book because I think that gave some nice insight into like, this is a little different. It's kind of lighter in tone. And that was also specifically tailored because he posts a lot of cartoons on Twitter and LinkedIn. So I thought that might resonate. And then it was very like, would love for you to check out the book. Can we send you an advanced copy? We'd love for you to blurb it if possible. But even if you just enjoy it, that's great too.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So that's really nice. Low pressure. And I think what's really important, and now as the book has come out, as I've not many, but have gotten a few inbound emails, having something specific and really showing that you know the other person's work. And so it's not just one of these generic, like, can I pick your brain? I probably sent this out to 50 people, and it's all written in like corporate speak. Like, I love the value you add to the world. It's like, what?
Yes.
and I think that, you know, people are looking for great people. I think especially Adam Grant or people that study the workplace, there's so much value in investing in new people entering the field. And so I think if you can communicate that you have worked really hard on something, that you really appreciate that person's specific work, just like, don't make it a pressure filled thing, right? Like, I'm just excited to be here with you. Here's what I would love, like specific ask. If not, totally fine.
Yeah. Gosh, that feels like the template for, you know, like the really like heartfelt, honest, it's more work, but then sort of writing up the boilerplate, like corporate speak thing and blasting it out to like a zillion people. But I have to believe the conversion rate on that is got to be so much higher. What do you feel like your conversion rate was on asking for, I know it doesn't have to be for blurbs, but like when you have to ask for stuff, that's a very sophisticated approach. So you've thought about this. What do you think, what percent of the time do you think that works?
I think it depends. I would say the response rate is very directly tied to how interesting the thing I have to offer is. Like, I've emailed people about like, hey, I have this product or this illustration and I'd love to do X with you around it. And I think it's really about like selecting the person that you think will actually respond to your thing. So I'll say just like general interest emails, probably a lower response rate. But to go back to your original question of like how this whole process started. So when I was in my early 20s, I studied economics and math and then wanted to do something more creative. But coming from that world was just like, also, my parents really, they're both academics. My dad's a doctor. And so like kind of implicitly had placed into my mind, art is a great way to be poor for life.
Yeah.
So I was just like, what do I do that's creative without like throwing my career out the window? And that was just like putting my feelings into charts. Or the first project I really did was 14 Ways an Economist Says I Love You, which is taking... Yeah, it's so nerdy, but it's like taking traditional econ charts and then turning them into Valentine's. So I had like the marginal returns of spending time with you will never diminish, or the S&P was in the red, but I wasn't blue because I shorted the market and went long on you. So just like super nerdy.
Oh man, this is so listeners, you can search for 14 Ways an Economist Says I Love You, and you can see the charts that Liz made, and they are amazing. I'm looking at them right now. They're amazing. They look super, super real. Like they look like real, like economics textbook charts.
That's because I had no design skills. And so I think I made those in a mix of like Excel and MS Paint. So I feel like I've evolved. My design has evolved significantly since then. But in that case, I remember it was right before Valentine's Day and I had kind of just gone through a breakup and was feeling really low. And so I just had made these charts. I'd put them on my website. And then I also followed prominent econ bloggers because that was my life in a previous life. And so I just emailed three of them. And it was very much like, hey, I made these charts. They're econ charts for Valentine's Day. Maybe you like them. Could you tweet about them or like put them on your site? Just thought you might enjoy. Like, again, super not a hard ask. And that was really just coming out of a place of, I'm depressed, I don't care. You know, like, if they don't respond to me, I can't get any lower, so whatever. And on that one, I actually had all three of them respond to me and end up posting them. And then those charts went viral and were featured in a bunch of publications. And I think through that, I then had more opportunities to do similar, like, chart feelings, artsy stuff. And then actually through that, ended up getting a book agent, which started this whole journey.
But interesting.
Yeah, okay. But I just look back at that, sending those three emails, and granted, I don't know the counterfactual, like, I could have done something else at some point, but to me, it was just so crucial. And again, it was very like, I knew the target audience. These were people that I genuinely had followed for years. And so,
yeah, you're not, I was about to say, when you started saying like, oh, I studied economics, like, oh, well, your parents made you, but you really wanted to do art. But clearly, like, you actually liked it. Like, you were into it. Yeah.
So quick side note is, I'm also currently dating an econ PhD. And we have brought economics into our relationship. And so everyone is always like, okay. What? Oh, God.
Yeah, explain. No, explain. Yeah. Good.
So we have this thing where I think sometimes, let's say that there's a school event that he has and he asks me to go. Sometimes it's hard to tell as a partner, like, how important is this to you? Is this like, I need to be there, it's crucial for you? Or is this like an, I don't really care? And so we've actually, he'll say, I'd like you to go with this to me. It's worth like $10 for you to go to this with me. and then what I will say, because we want to maximize happiness in our relationship, I can say like, okay, I'll go with you. Or I can say, it's worth $15 to me to stay home and like work on my things. And then we'll like negotiate the terms.
And that usually, is excellent.
We most of the time like don't actually end up Venmoing each other money, but it's a really useful thing to be like, you know, like my parents came to town and he's met them before, but I was like, hey, we're going to dinner on Tuesday, like $200. I really want you there. And then he was like, okay, I'll go. So, yeah, I'm serious about the economics part.
That's great. That is great. I mean, that's what we need, because gosh, I feel like there's so much stuff that where my wife and I are like, you know, trying to make a decision about what to do or trying to get something done, whatever, like, oh, somebody's got to, you know, we need to go pick up our younger son at school and like, who's going to do it? What a nice way to make this sort of verbal, like, I really want to help you out, but like, I have all this stuff I need to do. And like, we're both kind of in this zone of like wanting to help each other. What a nice way to make it crisp. Like, what is it really worth? Like, I love that.
Yeah. Some people definitely have the opposite response, which is like, you guys are gross. So I appreciate that it's resonating.
No, that's, I think more stuff should be transactional.
Amazing.
Oh man. But because actually, how nice is it for him to know that that dinner is worth $200? It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Like, it makes it really clear. It's not like, oh, I'm just expecting you to do this thing. Like,
yeah.
Not that anyone would, but like, it is easy when you're in a relationship with anybody, whether it's romantic or otherwise, to just sort of, you know, expect and stop thinking like, gosh, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
It does. Have you written about that? You should write about that.
I should write about it. It does.
That is a book.
Yeah. Like, what it's like to date an economist. It does. I will say, it does feel bad when he's like, oh, there's this, my friends and I are grabbing drinks. And I say, how much for me to go with you? And he'll say $0.
Oh, yes.
I'm like, hey.
Right. Right.
You won't
be
there. Yeah. Generally, as a general construct, it's useful.
Right. God, that was so great. I'm rebooting my brain now back to, in case you didn't notice, Liz, I'm not really a professional interviewer, but we were talking about, oh yeah, I know. So you study economics, you do the 14 ways an economist says I love you. By the way, I love that this is like a really crafted thing. It looks like you put a lot of effort into it. There's like 14 of them. It's not just one, like it's a lot of stuff. And you also went to the trouble of pitching it to places that might kind of amplify it. And it's interesting to me because I feel like the normal course of action that I would suggest to people would be, oh, start small, you know, get in a lot of reps and like go and go and go. Not that that's bad advice. I'm not necessarily going to discard that now. You did this in a different way. You like crafted something really big and then you pitched it. And because that succeeded, because you kind of went all in on that, it seems like a lot of stuff sort of started from that little thing. I don't know. Is that?
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I've, especially like when I moved to San Francisco and started working in tech, adopted more of the like iterate, get stuff out, test it mentality. Right. But I do think there is probably the right balance. What I've tried to do now is like iterate on some stuff, but then I think there are some ideas that you have, and usually they're the ones that are especially meaningful to you, where it is important to take the time and, you know, like really let the project breathe and maybe don't show it to people for a while, put it on the back burner, come back to it. So I think having a balance of like the small stuff that you're putting out that's relatively easy to produce, but then still having that like larger project that maybe will have a larger impact. And I think a book is 100%
yes
in that realm. Like I just, especially working in tech where it was A/B test this, you know, we were shipping, yeah, when I was at Genius, yeah, we were like shipping stuff every day and then getting user feedback. To be in this bubble for 3 years where there's nothing that's going out into the world was so strange.
Yeah, it's definitely like the marshmallow thing, which I guess has been debunked, but like delayed gratification. It's definitely like a big marshmallow. and then like sadly, like as you mentioned at the beginning, like when it actually comes out, it's like a bit like, oh, actually, yeah, waiting for the marshmallow was more fun than eating it. Because marshmallows are kind of gross on their own.
Yeah.
But so economics major, you come out with these illustrations, .. you're working at Rap Genius. Like what? what happened?
Yeah. So I worked as an economic consultant after I graduated. Okay. And that is like big companies sue each other. They hire law firms, the law firm hires the economic consultant to figure out like how much money each side should get. If someone, let's say, stole an idea, how much money did they cost the person they stole the idea from, that kind of thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think two things happened. I totally burnt out of that job. Like I was getting, by the end of it, I was getting migraines. I just physically couldn't work anymore. And so one reason was I was on a dreary case. So my case was Lehman Brothers had gone bankrupt, defaulted on AAA rated corporate bonds. A lot of pension funds lost a ton of money for their pensioners. So they were suing Lehman Brothers saying like, we don't have any money for retirement anymore. You owe us that money because you didn't let us know that it was really dire and you were going to go bankrupt. And my job was essentially to prove that Lehman Brothers didn't owe anybody any money. So that, I think like from a meaningful perspective, that was just like a particularly bad case to work on.
Yeah.
And then I also was operating under this idea that I had this job I had always wanted. I was putting on a suit. I was going into a big, tall building every day.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like very successful. Where
was this in? Is this in New York?
This is in Chicago.
In Chicago.
Okay. And so I thought also that I just couldn't have emotions at work, and that I didn't even realize that like there was an opportunity to ever talk to your manager and say, hey, I've been here 6 months. These are the parts of my job I really love, and these are the ones that don't come as naturally to me. How can I shift my responsibilities? How might this affect other jobs I could have at this organization? I just thought you put your head down, you do the work, you do it well, you put up with anything, especially early in your career, and any emotion you just suppress and get rid of.
Right, right.
And I think that, especially now having done all this research, that's such a bad strategy. One, it's biologically impossible not to feel. We evolved to have emotions. We have them all the time. You can't get rid of them unless you're a sociopath. And then there's a lot of other problems to talk about. but I think it's also really...
My co-host Jonathan is a sociopath. So I know how that goes.
but yeah, and so I think looking back, if I had just known that I didn't even talk about this really with friends. And so even if I had known that if you have a colleague that you're getting close with, you can maybe talk about this with them,
yeah,
or have a conversation with your manager. And like, how do you have that conversation? Even these simple things are like, even just being given permission to like, you're having a bad day at your job, totally normal. Everyone has bad days at their job. You know, you don't always have to operate under this. I love this. This is my passion. I'm crushing it 24/7.
So you were working for a consultancy or like a law firm?
Yeah.
A consultancy. Like, do you feel like given the nature, it sounds like very buttoned up corporate world.
Mm-hmm.
If you had just had the confidence to speak about how you were feeling about what was going on, do you think there was an avenue there, or is that more of a different company culture that can accept that? Like, was your right out of school self at that time, were you right that you had to suppress it, or?
Yeah. So I think actually there would have been. I'm still friends with a lot of my colleagues and my old boss. And especially like now with the book, we've talked about these things. And so I do think there would have been room for that. That said, I think that's not every organization. Like, I think if you're an investment banker, you can't go to your boss and be like, I'm having a lot of feelings. I think that's not going to go over well.
Right.
But then there are still ways. So one of the pieces of advice that my co-author Molly and I give in the book is, if you work in an organization where it's people are just going to laugh you out the door, if you're like, let's all get in a ball pit and talk about our feelings, you can address the need behind your feelings. So if you're feeling really anxious and it's because you don't really know if your priorities are aligned with your boss, you can just go to your boss and have all your priorities listed and say, hey, here's a list. Can you just make sure that I've organized this in the way you want me to so I can be sure I'm working on the right things? If you are anxious because you're worried about meeting a deadline, you can go to your colleagues, go to your manager and say, hey, here's what I've done. Here's why I'm worried about this deadline. Is there anything we can cut or that I can hand off to someone else just to make sure the work gets done in time? So often taking the time to sit back, try and understand where that feeling is coming from, and then going to your colleagues and addressing the need behind that feeling is a way to still make yourself less anxious and kind of practice emotional self-care without flagging everything as like, hey, I'm going to talk about my emotions right now.
So the emotion, maybe or maybe not, it would actually not go over well for you to talk about your emotion. But if you can figure out what is at the root of that, there are often things that will feel to anyone very work-related that you can talk about that are the causes of many of those emotions. That totally makes sense to me. And it's super smart, by the way, because I can easily, like in my head, I'm imagining, and I won't necessarily share them because I don't know if people want to hear about my like work feelings from 20 years ago, but like I could definitely like remember lots of things that I felt that were connected to things that were about, you know, my responsibility was felt too large or too small, mm-hmm. or I don't understand, like the timeline for this thing is not right. It's too fast or too slow. Or like there were probably very tactical, like non-touchy feely reasons why I was feeling pissed off or stressed or whatever. But what if you just like don't know your own feelings? That makes sense to me that there could be a way to unpack it. But I'm also thinking in the moment when I am feeling down or like whatever, like that consumes my brain and I'm not that smart about it. And I need like, I actually need help to figure it out. So if you can't go to your boss, or how do you get to the point where you actually know what's behind it?
Yeah. So one of the pieces of advice that we give over and over again that's really useful for people is just sit down and write everything you're feeling. And if in a moment you feel really strongly and you're not able to articulate, like, I'm feeling frustrated, I'm feeling this, just take a step back. I hate the advice, never go to bed angry. Like, sometimes we should absolutely just go to sleep. Like, do not stay up and delve into this thing. There's nothing that needs to be like hashed out in the moment when everyone's emotions are running high. So I think the first piece of advice is like, if you're having a strong reaction to something, I actually saw a colleague do this once and I thought it was amazing, where she was just like, I'm having a strong reaction to your statement and I just need a moment. And I thought that was a really nice way of kind of, again, speaking to this like emotion that she was having without making it into like a crazy moment for everyone. I don't know.
And
like,
did she just like take a few deep breaths and then punch you in the face?
Like, I need to write, like, get my attack strategy right.
Yep. No, actually, yes. Punch in the face is appropriate after calmly thinking about it for a minute.
No, but I think, I mean, in like, again, if you're in kind of an argument or something, it's usually really important to be able to speak about your emotions or think about your emotions without getting emotional. And so one of the best ways to do that is just to go for a walk, like distance yourself from the thing that's causing you to have such a strong reaction if you can. And then once you've done that, write down everything you're feeling. And we talk about this in the book in particular in relation to decision making. So there's a lot of discussion of like, you should always listen to your gut. You should never listen to your gut. And there's actually a science to listening to your gut, which is that some emotions are really useful and some are just noise that are going to stick their tentacles into your decision making and make you pick something that, you know, back to your future self will regret. And so write down everything you're feeling. And then I'll relay this back to decision making because I think it's a nice example, which is go through each of the things you wrote down and figure out, like, is this related to the decision at hand or is this something totally unrelated? So example is, if I wrote down anxiety and envy, anxiety is maybe because there was a lot of traffic when I came into the office and I know there's going to be a lot of traffic going home and I'm just worried about getting home in time for a dinner I had scheduled. That has absolutely nothing with the decision I'm trying to make at work, even though it might really put me in like a high energy state. So I need to just be able to say, okay, this emotion, I need to kind of take into my head, I'm very anxious right now. And so I need to like bring that down a little or make sure as much as I can to put that aside while I'm making this decision. Now, when I get to envy, which is on the list, envy is actually, if we process it, can really reveal what we value. So for example, if there's a friend you have and they get promoted and you're really envious of them, it might be that they suddenly have a job that you really want. And that can be really useful when you're making a decision of like, what other jobs should I apply for? What industries are interesting to me? We talked to Gretchen Rubin, who wrote The Happiness Project and The Four Tendencies, and who's amazing. And she said she was a lawyer and that her big epiphany was when she was looking in a magazine that listed people's careers. And when she saw people who had amazing law careers, she felt fine. You know, she was impressed, but nothing more. Yeah. And then when she read about writers, she just felt like sick with jealousy. And she said for her, that was a really strong signal of like, oh, maybe I want to try being a writer. And that actually informed a lot of her decisions after that.
Wow.
So I think like really listing what you're feeling and then figuring out like, this one is telling me something useful. And this one is just like a fly buzzing around my head that's distracting to me. Even just having that list can be so valuable in going forward and figuring out like how to process everything going on inside you.
Well, this, I like to talk about Harry Potter at least once an episode. And this, I've been reading the series out loud again now to my younger son. Ooh. And I've read them many times to myself and then to my older son. So great. Oh God, it's the best. Speaking of people who are writers who just changed my life, J.K. Rowling, thank you. So anyway, this reminds me of the Pensieve. You know, the Pensieve is where, I don't know if you don't have to acknowledge whether you actually are into Harry Potter or not, but sort of Dumbledore like pulls the thoughts out of his head with his wand and he puts them in this dish and then he can look at them. And it's actually, gosh, it's so powerful. I mean, I know from doing like design sprints and just talking to companies, like if you're talking to a team of people or a person, if you just write down like what they say as they're saying it, and then they give them the chance to look at it and say, oh, which of these things is important? It feels different when you're looking at it captured somewhere than it does when it's in your head. That is like a really powerful piece of advice. In our family, we're just making like a big decision and really wrestling with it for a couple months and then had this crystallizing moment where we're like, oh, let's just like write down all the stuff that we're thinking about that we value here, because your brain just can't keep track of everything, which is kind of where emotions come in. They're like, I don't know if this is accurate. Actually, you tell me if this is accurate, but like, I feel like emotions seems like they're almost like often a shortcut for our brain to be like, look, I can't bring up all the data right now, but like the synthesis of the data is kind of this, like the emotion's kind of like a way to like give you like a quick shortcut on it. And if your rational brain needs more information, writing it down seems, that's so smart.
Yeah, for sure. And we also say often, you should treat your emotions like another data point. So it's often your brain. I think I really like to relate this to how you feel when you walk into a space. And I think I'm particularly, as a designer, like sensitive to aesthetic choices and lighting and all that. But when I walk into a space, I was just recently looking for apartments. And so there are some I walk in and I'm like, nope. And then there's others where I walk in and I was like, yes, I really like it here. And I think, again, that's my brain just taking all these crazy things coming at it into and synthesizing it and spitting out like, you feel good, you feel bad. That said, that feeling should be taken along with like, well, is this affordable? You know, is this a good location? All of that stuff.
Yes.
But it's, again, a useful like additional thing to have.
Totally. Yeah. So I feel like now I'm like, okay, gosh, I want to make sure I hear your story still. So, and I've been leading us astray a little bit, but you're at the consultancy and then like what happened there that leads you to, you kind of started going in, seems like a different direction.
Yeah. So I decided that, well, I guess it was kind of decided for me again, because I was getting these migraines that I just couldn't like work anymore. But what I had been doing every day, which maybe people can relate to, is I had been escaping by going to Starbucks and getting a cup of coffee in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And kind of as I worked there longer, I started to go twice a day. And so these baristas there knew me. And this was like a while ago. This was before you could get on your parents' health insurance. So when I was leaving this job, one, I didn't have like an income anymore. I had some savings, but still wanted to make money. And then two, I didn't have health insurance. And so I had read somewhere that at Starbucks, if you work part-time, you'll still get full benefits. So I quit my job and then just walked right to the Starbucks I got to every afternoon.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I need a job. Can I work here? And so went through the interview process and then became a barista. And I very much thought at that time, like I felt totally lost and was probably like very anxious and depressed. And I thought the Starbucks thing would be like a good way of forcing me out of the house and I would learn how to make a cappuccino. But I probably semi-arrogantly was like, I don't think I'll learn that much. I just didn't see it as like a learning opportunity.
Yeah.
And to me, Starbucks is fascinating because the pastries are all laid out really according to a strict rubric. The lighting changes based on the time of day. The music changes based on the time of day. At the time,
I did not know that.
Yeah. It's like, so their whole philosophy, and again, this was like 7-8 years ago, so it might have changed. But at the time, the philosophy was you have work, you have home, and then Starbucks should be like your third place. And so they wanted to make it feel really inviting. They wanted it to be like designed nicely. They also wanted it to be a place where you could go. By the way, Starbucks is not paying me to say this. Just want to
point out. No, I mean, well, I think you're making them look both really good and also coldly calculated. Yeah. So I think it's balanced. Okay. I would say that, like, coming from, I'm from Washington State and like lived in Seattle for many years before moving to San Francisco. And I feel like whenever I'm like traveling around or, you know, just anywhere but Seattle, Seattle is really has this idea of the third place down. And I feel like they have it because the weather sucks and so dark in the wintertime and well, really like kind of a lot of the year. And so you kind of want to go somewhere, but you need some space. Like you're not going to be just like in and out because you kind of don't want to be outside.
Yeah.
Anyway, I feel like one of the things that Starbucks did was like take that, like, you know, whenever I go into some place, I'm like, oh yeah, this is like a little bit of that feeling of like comfort, but I had no idea why that was, happening.
I mean, it is very, very planned out.
Interesting.
Oh, one last thing that I thought was interesting was at the time they had this policy where every table at the Starbucks should be round, not square. And that was because at a round table, it's not obvious that there are like three people that are not sitting with you. So one, you could fit more people around it. But two, like if I'm sitting alone, it's not in their mind as awkward as if I'm like sitting alone there's no one at this corner, no one at that corner, no one at this corner. So that job for me ended up being this like crazy crash course into how lucrative and powerful design could be.
But how did you, did they like day one, were they like, here's everything we're doing? Or
no, So I think it was like week two when and it was funny because I'd been doing this too, but I was just kind of blown away by how much money people spent at Starbucks and how much they like clearly had an emotional connection to it. Some of that is absolutely that you're just like giving them the drug they want. Like, here's your caffeine. But because this was also then I was working through the holiday season and the red cups came out and people were just like so excited about the red cups and it really did feel festive. And then I also probably peppered the manager with questions. And I remember someone came in and was like, hey, I have a gift card for Starbucks. It's in Canadian dollars. Can I use that here in US dollars? I bought it like a year ago. And I think I remember just immediately, I was like, oh, weird. I wonder if there's like an arbitrage opportunity here where you could. And the person was like, what are you talking about? So I think I also just like was like just a total econ nerd about the whole thing. And that kind of got me. Then I started getting really into design and taught myself data visualization, actually like took the plunge and got Adobe Illustrator to sort of learn more formal design skills. And that eventually led me then to tech and working at Rap Genius, where I was in kind of like a product community role, dabbling in both, figuring out the users that were using the product, how should that inform design decisions. But yeah, I think it was really that Starbucks job was so formative for me. And I think looking back, it's a little sad that something had to convince me that, hey, art actually can make you a ton of money if you are, you know, applying it in interesting ways.
Did you never study art in a formal way?
No. I have a cousin who had got an art history degree. And so.
Well, having a cousin who got an art history degree does not really cut it.
No, but I think like, I think was like this one person that like always exposed me to art. She was maybe 10, 15 years older than I was.
Yeah.
And so I think really like nurtured that okay. part of me when I was
so very, very, very yeah, informal yeah, yeah. art degree.
No, but it's like, art degree is my degree.
Yeah.
I'm a transitive property. That's how it works.
I know a guy who's a physician, so please call me Dr. Knapp.
Yeah, that'll be $400.
Yeah. Here's your pills. Here are your pills for your flu. So Rap Genius, and so, one thing that's cool about this is that some things happened to you early in your career that were just like, seems like you were like not on the right track, not happy with what was going on. And then like in hindsight, you've made a lot out of those experiences. It sounds like you've like mined those. And it's interesting that Starbucks kind of felt like, hearing you talk about it, feels like the moment when you started to feel this agency and like understanding of like, oh, these are the patterns. This is what clicks for me. And I don't know, maybe I'm reading into it too
much. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure some of it is like, we can create a great narrative about anything looking back.
Totally.
No, I mean, I think for me too, it was such a kind of crash and burn situation that I was also terrified of applying to another consultancy or kind of thing that I would be at full time and could see myself being at for multiple years, because I had been so sure that this job was going to be great. And then it wasn't. Yeah. And so I think that forced me also to be like, okay, I felt bad. And I guess if I feel bad at a job, I'm not going to be good at it. So what does that mean? How do I not feel bad? What are jobs that won't make me feel bad? It was just like a real crisis mode. Like, I need to figure out what I like. Otherwise, I don't know, you know, how I'm going to make money or what I'm doing with the rest of like my 70, 80 years on earth.
That sets me up kind of nicely to ask you sort of more of like a stock. Hey, Liz, welcome to the book interview show. Question, which is good because I know you have to run and like you have like 4 minutes more. And so I'm really curious to hear you talk more about this, especially in light of what you were just saying. And it's the advice in the book, which is be less passionate about your job. So can you explain what that means and why that's good advice?
Yeah. So that's the big caveat, is we're not saying don't be passionate about your work. It's great to have a job that you love, that you go into every day excited about, or that you sit at your computer if you work from home. I think this happened to me a lot in my first job, which is I also was operating under this mentality of like successful people just work, work, work. And that you just for a few years, you have to make work your whole life. And so I thought the way to be successful at work is to work all the time. And it's actually crucial to take breaks and to cultivate your personal relationships and to actually just like create a life that makes you happy. And so two reasons for that, three. One is that tons of research shows that we are more productive when we take breaks. I think everyone has had, after you've been staring at your computer for 12 hours, you have just like a brain melty feeling where like you hate everything you've done, nothing makes sense, and you might actually end up making your work worse if you keep fiddling around with it.
For me, honestly, it's like shorter and shorter period of time too. I'm down to like 45 minutes.
Yeah, I feel that too. And then the second is, you just need some emotional distance from your work. I think nowadays, you know, the lines between our professional and personal lives are so porous. Like, you basically, I think so many people, they are at work and then they go home so they can work from home the rest of the evening. That's, you know, when your whole life is work, when you're not having other things going that bring you happiness, that make you feel valued, if you get a piece of critical feedback, it feels way worse if there's not a side project that you're working on, or you don't have a partner to come home to, or like a best friend or a dog or something, someone else to just be like, I love you, you're valued, like you make me happy, you bring a lot to the table. So a lot of it is also just like being more resilient at work is easier if work isn't everything in your life. And then the last thing is, I was talking with a friend about this recently, that I definitely operated under this mentality of, when I get that promotion, I'll be happy. Or like, when I get that raise, I'll be happy.
Right.
And I think just looking at my career, and then there's also research to back this up, it's much more, when I've created a life that makes me happy, I'm much more likely to get that promotion. And if I'm happy, if I'm engaged with my work, but I'm also like, you know, I have a home life that brings me joy, and I have like some sports that I'm into, or art or whatever it is, reading, that also sustains me, then you're much more likely to get a raise. It's more about
Oh, okay. So what you said was not what I expected you to say. I expected you to say the research shows that when you get that thing, your happiness will sort of go back to baseline pretty quickly.
It says that
That's
too.
What I expected you to say. Well, no, but the, but what you said is way more interesting. Like, get your act together, more or less. I mean, in a gentler way, but like, make yourself happy, and the happy people, the people who have that stuff set, are more likely to have a good outcome at the work stuff. Like, that's actually the place to go to figure out first. I mean, that, if I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more that just being happy, kind of like being content. I think happiness is obviously often a moving target, but being content is just tied with all these positive things like well-being, productivity. There's lots of research too that shows, I think a lot of this looks at students actually, but when we are stressed, when there's a lot going on in our lives, when we're unhappy, it just puts a huge damper on our ability to process information, to be quick on our feet. And so I think creating a life, maybe I won't be as strong as say happiness, but that like you feel good in, that consistently provides you with positive signals where you're taking care of yourself, I think that puts you in a position to just be better at work, which then leads to good things.
So if you feel like you're kind of choosing between well-being and like driving hard to get that next thing or milestone at work, might want to invest in well-being first, with the idea that that's almost just like upgrading your hardware. Like,
yeah,
that's going to make you more able to do everything.
Yeah,
else.
It's just taking the long view. And obviously sometimes like you really are going to have to work late and
yes,
like meet a deadline
right, yes.
and everything. But I've thought about this a lot with the book launch. We did an event in New York and then San Francisco in the span of 2 days. It was like crazy traveling
then
like workshops and speaking things, and you need to prepare for all of those. And for me, I was like, this is not sustainable for me. I can do this for a week, but if I tried to push myself to do this for a whole month or for 2 months, I would just be sick for a month. You know, and my productivity over that time, if you're sick a month and driving hard a month, your productivity is probably the same as if you're just kind of going at a good pace for 2 months.
Your answer to that was very satisfying because it did not go in the direction I expected. And I feel kind of like encouraged to change my approach to some projects a little bit.
Oh, cool.
You know, make sure that I'm kind of doing, like I'm thinking about this science fiction book project I'm working on, which has been a very long process.
Which I also like want to hear way more about at some point.
Yeah, well, next interview, okay. we'll delve in. Well, I'll even though I mostly talk just about myself during this interview, I'll really do it next time. But yeah, like I need to get back to that being fun and like a source of joy and not just trying to squeeze the pages out and stare at the screen, which is, it's easy to get into that trap where you want to produce it.
Yeah. I have one last tip on that, which has also generated a lot of sarcastic comments from my parents. But the tip is like a nice little mindset shift is when you find yourself saying like, oh, I have to write this chapter, or I have to give this workshop, I have to go into the office tomorrow. It can often be really useful to flip it and say like, I get to. So I get to write this chapter. I get to work on this project that I've wanted to do for so long. I get to like go to a job that does pay me well and like does bring me satisfaction.
Yeah.
So I find that can be like a useful kind of reset. And then the sarcastic comments from my parents are that since I've said that, my dad, who lives in Chicago, he sent me a text a few days ago in the midst of the Chicago polar vortex. And it was, I'd get to shovel the driveway again this morning. So it definitely doesn't work all the time, but I think it can be useful to at least like see if that reframing is valuable.
Yeah, no, it's certainly worth a try.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we live in the Bay Area. We don't get a lot of snow, no snow. So once I would enjoy shoveling the walkway. He's probably done it like a 1,700 times
I'm
this
sure
winter,
he'd
but
be
you know,
happy
once
to have you come over
to have me come in. Yeah. I'd be like, yeah, come on over, California boy. Yeah. Let's see how you like it. It's minus 60 out. Yeah. Well, on that note, I'm gonna let you go to your next thing. Liz, it's been so fun to have you on. Thank you for taking the time to talk about this.
Yeah,
stuff.
Thanks. I love that it's like such a casual conversation. It was really fun to dive into all these topics with you.
Where can people find you on the internet?
Yes. So the book is, again, No Hard Feelings. The Secret Power of Embracing Emotions at Work. And that is on Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, at your local bookstore. And then we also have on our website, Liz and Molly, and Molly is M-O-L-L-I-E. We have a discussion guide for the book. We also have a bunch of assessments you can take. So are you an over-emoter, an under-emoter? Do you practice enough emotional self-care? Do you feel belonging at your organization? Those are some of the assessments we have. So I think that's a great place. There's also a link to Instagram where we post illustrations. So I would say book and then the website are good starting points.
Book and the website. Book, you can get it. It's on Audible. It's on Kindle. It's like everywhere. It's a big deal book. It's everywhere. You should get it probably in multiple forms would be my advice, because you're probably going to want the audiobook, but you are definitely going to want the hard copy. This is one of the best looking books.
Oh.
Beautiful illustrations. The illustrations have this really nice blue ink with the illustration. It's just, it's gorgeous. So make sure that if you get the audiobook, you also get the hard copy, or the Kindle, you're going to also want the hard copy. Anyway, LizandMolly.com. Thank you so much. It's traditional to sing out the theme song like we did at the beginning, and you don't really know the song that's going to be laid underneath, but it doesn't really matter. If you feel comfortable, would you like to sing with me?
Sure.
Okay. So you just say Product Breakfast Club, and it doesn't really matter what tune okay. or what like sort of note. I really can't sing.
All right,
but we'll just sort of say, yeah, okay.
Product Breakfast Club. The product breakfast club.
Bye, everybody. That might have been one of the best songs ever, actually.
Yay.
That was great, Liz. Thank you, Liz. Bye, everybody.
Bye.